It's a somewhat famous quote by Donald Rumsfeld. He said, "There are things we know now that we once didn't know. There are things we don't know now that we will learn one day. And there are things we don't know that maybe we will never know." Kind of sounds like gobbledygook, but at the same time, it's appropriate for Antarctica, because Antarctica is a very mysterious place. It's the least visited part of this planet ever visited, and at the same time, it's the fifth largest continent. It's larger than Europe. It is twice the size of Australia, and it's about the size of the lower 48 states and Canada combined. So I think that should give you an idea how vast the distances are. So when asked, "Oh, did you go to New Schwabenland, or did you go to the South Pole, or did you go to all these other locations?" it would kind of be akin to traveling very long distances. Of course, the climate is extremely inhospitable. Right around now, all the researchers are leaving. There are about 4,000 researchers at all the bases and support staff. That goes down to a skeleton crew of only 1,000 people from now until October, when people start heading back there and tourism starts up again. Tourism only goes for about 3 months, and that is the summer solstice down there, which is winter solstice up here. So approximately late October until end of Feb. If anybody you're thinking of going, the best way to do it is by cruise ship, and 90% of those leave from a town called Ushuaia in Argentina. So I start this talk with scientific knowledge, things we know quite a bit about, and then I'm going to go into what is speculated down there. These are some maps that have just come up recently. The first one on the left is the recently completed reference elevation model of Antarctica, or REMA. On the right is the mass of accumulated Antarctic change in the 20th century, as depicted by NASA's Scientific Visualization Studio. And why this map is so important is because this is the region I was in, Palmer Peninsula. That area is rapidly melting. There's no doubt about it. I'll show you some evidence of that later. But the blue areas is where Antarctica is accumulating ice. On my return trip from this four-month journey, I had a 12-hour layover in Miami Beach, and I went down to the beach. There's no discernible sea level rise. I mean, we've heard a lot about it, that it's going to inundate cities. But it would appear that Mother Nature has a way of settling the melting in some areas with the rising ice in other areas. I should point out that Antarctica is a desert continent. It is one of the driest places on Earth with very little humidity. They have a big problem with static electricity at the South Pole base because of the lack of humidity. And I'll just use this map to give you a quick little tour. I wish I had a laser pointer to do this, but I guess I'm tall enough to reach. Of course, this being the South Pole, and we're going to talk about the South Pole and a presumed large opening cavity near there. You can see how the ice is up on the polar plateau, 2 miles deep, sometimes close to 3 miles deep. It's the highest elevation continent in the world because of the ice. And the landmass that this sits on is one of the oldest landmass chunks in the world. Over 3 billion years old, it broke off from Gondwana land or Pangaea and moved down here. And I'm going to talk about some of the glacier or some of the fossils they found among the glacier fields. This is called the Trans-Antarctic Mountain. This is where a lot of the geothermal activity, volcanoes, are taking place. And while we're on this map, I'll just show you the highest point is about right there. It's called Vinson Massif. And if you want to win a bar bet, You could say, well, first, what's the name of the tallest mountain in Antarctica? Vincent Massif. And you could say, is it taller than the tallest mountain in the Alps, which is Mount Blanc? Yes, it is. Mount Blanc is 4810 meters. Vincent Massif is 4892. That's 16,050 feet. So there are big mountains down there. And it also is higher mountains than Australia or a central part of Europe. Almost the entire continent is below the Antarctic Circle, which you can see right about here, that circle all the way around, just like we have the Arctic Circle. What does that mean? It's where you have 24 hours of daylight on the summer solstice, just like in our Arctic Circle. And all those regions below it have 24 hours of daylight. It's very interesting to know that at the South Pole, where there is a U.S. station called Amundsen Scott, they have one sunrise and one sunset a year. The sun pokes up over the horizon 2 months before solstice. It just spins around and around and around, gets to an apex on the summer solstice, and then starts corkscrewing back down, and then, poop, down it goes. And they will not see the sun again for 8 months. You do have 2 months of twilight on either side, but 4 months of total darkness. It's so dark you can't even see the hand in front of your face. And it takes a special kind of person who can withstand that kind of isolation. There are seven countries that hold territorial claims to Antarctica. This is Argentina's claim. They have it posted up all over the place. And it's also a good place to see where we came from, out of southern Tierra del Fuego, sailed across the Drake Passage, and basically explored this area of Antarctica, the Palmer Peninsula. Got within 1 degree of the Antarctica Circle. So although seven countries hold territorial claims, none are internationally recognized. But these countries continue to strengthen their claims, and it's also as a result of military operations and testing that the Antarctica Treaty was ratified in 1962 by 60 countries. First, it started out with 12. Now it's up to 53 countries ratified. So Antarctica is actually a biosphere. It's the largest naturally preserved land in the world, which belongs to no nations. Now, with the Antarctica Treaty, they say you're not allowed to mine, you're not allowed to fish, just like the Monterey Bay is a protected marine sanctuary. It is protecting the whole continent. And there have been a lot of exploitation of minerals and animals. Many species of seal and whale were hunted to commercial extinction. The seal populations have bounced back, but the whales haven't quite gotten back at all. Blue whales, right whales, almost hunted to complete extinction. If not for a few pods that survived, they would have been gone forever. So it's great that they can at least come back in a protected area. So even though you have these territorial claims, now they're starting to find oil and other minerals under the seafloor. So once again, Antarctica could be under threat because they say, well, if it's under the seafloor, that's not really protected by the Antarctica Treaty. I hope that doesn't go through, but you never know. All right. Here is a picture of all the bases. There are about 50 countries that have bases I'll just show you the three American bases. That's Amundsen Scott at the South Pole, McMurdo, or MacTown as it's called, and the Palmer Base. And we did get to visit Palmer on this trip to see some of the research that's going on there. I was told that it was a military base. There are no military bases. That is a misconceived notion that military is only allowed to add support. If supplies needed to come in with an icebreaker or if an emergency evacuation was necessary. But they are not allowed to do military exercises. Now, is it possible that covert operations exist? Yes, it is. But nobody would tell us about it. Here's a couple pictures of, of our trip. See a lot of cruise ships. This is going through an area called the Lemire Channel. This is called Paradise Harbor. On the right is a former research station, now a museum, called Port Lockroy. It's just incredibly beautiful. Emily and an American on my boat, I was on a sailboat with 14 people, three Americans and 11 Poles, and the boat was from Gdansk, Poland, that we were able to hitch a ride with. Hey, Brooks, any chance you got the laser pointer? I think it might have ended up with you yesterday. Oh, you did. If you got a laser pointer, I could use one. That'd be great. We were up on the boat one day, and we're sailing along, and I pointed out how the only colors you see are black, blue, and white. Black of the mountains, white of the glacier and the clouds, blue of the ocean and the sky. And it occurred to me that when you scuba dive really deep, those are the only colors you see, black, blue, and white. And even the animals in Antarctica, such as whales and penguins, are just black and white. So you lose those primary colors. And if there was ever akin to an alien planet on Earth, I would have to say it's Antarctica. We were doing nuclear testing down there. And that's part of the flies to and goes to sea. That's where all points of latitude end at 90 degrees south. You can walk around all 24 time zones in a few minutes at the South Pole. There's also the magnetic South Pole. All compasses point here. You may have heard that the magnetic North Pole is on the move, and it is. It had been fairly stable around the Hudson Bay area. Now it's racing across the Arctic Ocean and heading towards Siberia. Some people think maybe this is a precursor to a pole shift. The other pole is the geomagnetic pole. And if you took a dipole magnet from the center of the Earth, it would point there. And this is close to where the Vostok station is. And I'm going to talk about the under ice lakes, subglacial lakes, including Lake Vostok. And the Russian base is right there near the geomagnetic South Pole. And this is where you get the most amount of southern lights. Like we get the northern lights, Aurora Borealis. They have Aurora Australis, which are only viewed by a few dozen people per year. It's one of the least observed phenomenons down there. And then you have the pole of relative inaccessibility. And what that means is that's the point that's the farthest away from any coastline. So it is the most remote point in the planet. And it's very difficult to get to, very cold up on the polar plateau. And interesting that there would be four poles. So we got a great opportunity to see some of the volcanism in action. Antarctica is actually the most volcanically active continent in the world. 91 active volcanoes. including this location we went to. There's Emily and our friend Luke walking by this old graveyard. It was a whaling station. This is called Deception Island, and it's actually a caldera of a volcano that sunk, and it's still very active. Out here, when we got to this location, the sand was all steaming. We took our shoes off. If the water was a little deeper and the tide wasn't coming in, we could have actually taken a hot spring there. So there's a lot of geothermal activity coming in. This is our sailboat that we're on. This is an area called Neptune Bellows, named by the early whalers and sealers, because there's always a gush of wind coming out of there. But also, right in the middle of this very narrow strait, there's a rock that's only 2 meters below the water. Many ships have sunk going in and out of Deception Island Bay there, including some fairly recently. And you can imagine, if your ship's going down in Antarctica, you're in a heap of trouble. But most people were able to get to shore, including a shipwreck just about 20 years ago, and not so much of a loss of life. And Antarctica is much like the rift zone of the continent is literally tearing apart, like the rift zone in Africa. So you have two plates that are colliding. You have a whole series of fault lines. I'll show you a map of some of those. And you have 91 active volcanoes, some of which are in a state of eruption with lava pools like Mount Erebus down near McMurdo. And quite a dynamic environment with volcanoes and 99% of the continent covered in ice. So truly the land of fire and ice. And they also come from outer space. Antarctica is one of the best places to collect meteorites because it's just a big white tableau. So anything that lands there gets collected every summer when the researchers come in. They treat the specimens very carefully. They keep them in a frozen state, only use tongs and gloves, never touch them, because these are artifacts from outer space. And then they are sent to the Johnson Space Center for further examination. Why is it treated that way? Well, they might contain life. And indeed, some have been found to have primitive forms of bacteria. We've heard of panspermia, the populating of planets with meteorites. Here's some of the areas where the meteorites can be found, and almost exclusively along the Trans-Antarctic mountain range. Because when the polar plateau moves towards these narrow mountain gaps, it consolidates whatever's there, and then it can expose meteorites that may have been locked in the ice for thousands of years. So they'll go out there and they'll find new meteorites every year. Over 99% of all meteorites come from Antarctica. Here's a picture of what they would look like, what you would find. And the team of researchers gathered around one to collect it and send it back. They've collected over 50,000 specimens and help us understand what is going on outside of this planet. This being the most famous one, this is called ALH 84001. You may have remembered about 10 or 15 years ago when they said that bacteria had been found on a meteorite that came from Mars. Well, how does that happen? The moon and Mars and other planets are continually struck with larger meteorites that can kick up dust that make it out to the atmosphere. And every once in a while, some of those specimens make their way to Earth. They'd be lost in the ocean. They'd be lost on most continents. But because Antarctica is just this big white tableau, they can be found and then studied. So it's actually very beneficial for the study of meteorites to have Antarctica as a collection point. All throughout Antarctica are subglacial lakes, which sit at the base of large ice sheets and remain liquid all year round, and that's because of the geothermal activity. There are huge domes under the ice. Some of those domes have geothermal pools. They have rivers that connect to other lakes, and they eventually will empty out into the Southern Ocean, which is the fifth ocean of the world. And it's very unique. It has a convergence point of the salty, warmer water meeting the more fresh water from the melting ice, and an upwelling of life. It's called the Antarctic Convergence. And it is one of the richest sources of small life, such as plankton, and is so essential to all of the other life on the planet. Here's a map of all the lakes they found, including Lake Vostok, off here on the right. Lake Vostok is about as big as Lake Ontario. It's massive. And it's under 2 miles under the ice. The Russians have just punctured through that 2,000-meter ice cap, 1.2 miles over Lake Vostok, and got to the dome in 2012. But their drill bit was contaminated with kerosene. It wasn't until 2016 that they got a non-contaminated sample down there to collect some water out of Lake Vostok. And already they're finding microscopic and bacterial evidence of completely unknown life forms. So it's really interesting to see the kind of work that's going on down there, because it is so vastly different from the different kind of research that's done up here. And Lake Vostok is one of the 10 largest lakes in the world. And it's only been discovered, proven to exist, containing water in 2012. So very new science. It's 50 kilometers wide and more than 240 kilometers north. If you saw my talk yesterday on South America, I showed you Lake Titicaca, the massive lake up on the Altiplano between Peru and Bolivia. Lake Vostok's bigger. That lake's only 100 miles across, where Lake Vostok's about 140 miles long. So just phenomenal lake. And what might be down there could really shake us up if there happens to be a kind of fish or other kind of life. So you see how deep it goes to get down there. And Lake Vostok existed before there was any ice, back when this continent just had deep troughs. So it's presumed that the water is millions of years old there. And this is what it looks like from the satellite. You can see the depression of it. That is the dome that exists over Lake Vostok. And Lake Vostok, like all the other subglacial lakes, has an outlet and will flow out of the hollows from the bedrock indentures and connects to other lakes by under ice rivers. This whole network of under ice subglacial lakes was only discovered in the late 1960s by British glaciologists using ice penetrating radar. Now over 150 subglacial lakes have been identified, most of which are about only 3 to 5 kilometers in length, But this area around Dome C has so many, they call it the Lake District. And mind you, that's all 2 miles under the ice. Here are those southern lights in the polar region called Aurora Australis. The reason it's called Australis is because long before the continent was even discovered, only in 1820 by sealers, first modern humans to set sight on it. Now I'm going to show you some maps a little later that pretty much show that we've known about this for a long time. But it was called Australis because that was the presumed name of the southern continent. Eventually, Australia got that name. Antarctica got its name because of Arctos. It's a constellation that you can see in the northern regions. And that's why the Arctic was named after Arctos. Antarctica means the opposite of Arctos. So when it was finally discovered, they gave it the name the opposite of the Arctic. That's why the names are somewhat similar. And as I mentioned, a good place to see the southern lights, if you're not in outer space, is from the Russian Vostok station at the geomagnetic pole. And there you get quite a show because it's right overhead. But so few people have ever seen it. Scientists do travel specifically to Antarctica to study these auroras. And by the way, the name Aurora comes from the Roman goddess of dawn. Millions of miles away, the sun produces electrically charged particles that are blown outwards across the solar system in a continuous solar wind. And when this solar wind passes through the Earth, this is how the lights are formed, the charged particles are attracted by the magnetic poles and then appear as light reflecting in the sky. I've seen them. I've only seen the northern lights once, and it was actually in Wyoming near Yellowstone. And they move ever so subtly, no sound whatsoever, but boy, do they light up the sky. It's quite an amazing thing to witness. Another view of the lights. They can appear green. They can appear blue. They have different colors. The northern and southern lights occur almost simultaneously. But because it's 24 hours of daylight in one of the poles, you can't see them in the day. So they're only visible at night. The Aurora Australis holds a particular mystique because so few people have ever been lucky enough to even observe them. Because the majority of people visit Antarctica in the astral summer when daylight hides aurora activity. It's only visible in Antarctica from April to October in the darkest months, starting now. So that sun has just set on the South Pole. They will not see the sun again for 8 months. So there are 60 scientific stations run by 23 different nations. We had the great opportunity of visiting 6 of them, all by different countries. Although there are no permanent human residents in Antarctica, you have about 1,000 winter population at some of these bases. Some of the bases close down. They're only seasonal. And others stay open all year round. This is the Palmer Base, the American Palmer Station. Now, see here, U.S. National Science Foundation. Because we were 3 Americans, this is a station chief named Robert Farrell. I was persistent enough to keep saying, hey, we're going to be down there. We want to visit your station. They only allow 10 boats in a year, and rarely ever cruise ships get to go there. They're doing a lot of scientific work here, studying the climate, studying the animals. This is the Palmer Base. All the buildings are separate, so in case there was a fire, it wouldn't take out the whole base. It would take some time to get people down there to help them. This is another base called Brown. And I'll tell you some really interesting information I got from one of the researchers there. This is Paradise Harbor, it's called. There's our boat. And at every one of the bases, you have these signs. There's some pingies down there. At first, it was such excitement to see our first penguins, just a couple of them at the Polish Arctowski base, because our crew was 11 Poles. They had set it up that we went there on King George Island. It was our first destination. We brought them some fresh fruit and vegetables, and they let us have a shower and let us join them for dinner and then breakfast the next day. We were so happy to see our first penguins. But when we got to some of the colonies, they're just thousands of them, and you can smell them before you can see them. And they're quite animated and loud and really fun to watch. And these cosmic rays have been detected at the South Pole. Some of the work that's going on down there is they have this ice cube technology buried under the ice. And we're going to go back to the South Pole here, but I'll just show you this example of what's happening. That being the South Pole, they're detecting down into the Earth and finding that there are cosmic waves coming out of the Earth at a 30-degree angle. This has only been discovered in the last year. They're also finding these neutrinos, which can travel through the Earth faster than the speed of light, also emanating out in the South Pole. So they're finding this really amazing new technology that's coming out of there. But according to my colleague Michael Sala, it's interesting that there may be a large cavity there, maybe a sub-Arctic dome under the South Pole, which may accumulate or attract some of these neutrinos or cosmic waves. It's not really known why, but it's just been detected lately, and it's caused quite a stir. I threw this in there because it was funny. Everywhere we went, all the bases said, the first thing if you're a new arrival is you have to watch the thing. You guys remember the thing? They discover a huge craft under the ice. There's Kurt Russell, Mac, as he was called in the movie. This was funny. It's called Donning Maudland, No Such Place. And I was looking at all these names. None of them exist. This is all just make-believe. Kemp Land, No Such Place. But interesting that this was where they were in the movie, and this is where the base was and where they found the UFO. This shoreline looks remarkably similar to the Neuschwabenland area of Germany's claim, and we'll get to that in a little bit. This is one of the most studied fossilized, actually freeze-dried seals in the world. It's over 3,000 years old. And it's at the dry valleys near McMurdo, one of the driest places on Earth. Somehow this seal crawled up there 3,000 years ago, died, and is literally mummified, freeze-dried from the extreme cold conditions. You also have mosses, lichens, and fungi. It's about the only thing that grows there. And it only grows in some of those rare places where there is no snow. And they call them oases. And it's usually because of geothermal activity, that there are some hot springs or something that is warming up the soil to the point where no snow accumulates. And then some of these lichens and mosses can grow. Fossilized dendrites. Yeah, we'll talk about some fossils, including dinosaur bones. In fact, we're almost there. But these are the dry valleys near McMurdo, the driest place in the world, and where that seal was found. Haven't seen rain for over 2 million years. Yeah, really dry. And here are some unique fossils. This is actually a plesiosaur, similar, or it is what is presumed to be the Loch Ness Monster, were found in Antarctica. This is the fossilized bone of a juvenile plesiosaur that was presumably killed by a volcanic eruption because it was found in a layer of lava. And not far from the dry valleys, primarily on top of the Beardmore Glacier. And remember that name, because if I go back next year, I want to go to the Beardmore Glacier. This is not only a paranormal hotspot, but at the top of the Beardmore Glacier is Mount Buckley, where four different Mesozoic finds have been collected. The early Triassic assemblage is dominated by synapsids, an extinct group of animals that link primitive reptiles to mammals, only found in Antarctica. They have completely unique species of dinosaur that are only found down there. And in addition to terrestrial animals, large extinct marine plesiosaurs and land dinosaurs have also been found. This one is one of those unique only to Antarctica. It's kind of like a massive giant salamander. And that arrow shows you the region where it was found. The ribs of this prosauropod were found in the mouth of another dinosaur when it died, called a Cryolophosaur, leading to the assumption that the carnivore may have choked to death on its last meal, eaten one of these giant salamanders. It died, it fell into the sediment level, it was buried, and then found many million years later, also at the Beardmore Glacier. That's the location. So this is this marine biologist named Manuel Novello, who I met at the Brown Base that I just showed you. He is studying these ice fish. These ice fish are in the mackerel family of fish. They're unique only to Antarctica, and they live in sub-freezing water. Now, mind you, this is us in the summer, and there are still glaciers floating around. And he studies these different varieties of ice fish. They are the only vertebrate fish that do not have hemoglobin in their blood. They don't have red blood. They have white blood. They're kind of translucent to live in these climates. Instead of having red blood like most other fish, their white blood makes them unique, as well as their bones are reduced in weight with less calcium. And the glycoproteins in their bodies contain a sort of antifreeze protein, which prevents them from freezing because they live in subarctic waters. It's amazing. The oxygen is carried in their blood plasma, but it has only 10% of the oxygen-carrying capacity of fish blood that contain hemoglobin. So they're completely wired differently from regular mackerel fish, in which they're closely related to. Some other images of some of these ice fish, several subspecies of the ice fish down there. And here we are back to Palmer Base. We didn't, but Manuel was going out right when we were leaving, and he collects samples every day. We didn't fish. We should have fished. So here's an example of global warming going on there. Bob Farrell said, make sure you see the painting in the gallery that was painted in 1985. And it is this scene today. See that island? It's called Pie Island. About 3 years ago, there was a ice bridge that connected the two, and it collapsed on Pie Day. So they named it Pie Island, and it's currently under there. So when this artist did this painting, they didn't even know Pie Island exists. So new islands are emerging from the melting ice. Bob Farrell said that this ice cap itself is just shrinking, is just dropping in elevation from the time he first started working there over 20 years ago. You would not be able to see the mountain range from Palmer Base on Anvers Island, but now you can. So rapidly melting in this part of Antarctica, but also raising in other parts. It is one of the most rapidly warming places on the planet. The average wintertime temperature in Palmer has risen more than 6 degrees in the last 50 years. And this has resulted in a decrease in winter sea ice extent and has caused many glaciers in the area we were in to recede. Here we are. These are these penguin colonies that you can get right up to. These were actually taken with my iPhone. And, you know, with iPhone, they're kind of a fisheye lens. I was literally about this close to this mother. And look at her. She's not even looking at me. They have no fear of humans because we're not a natural enemy to them. They don't really see us as being a problem. But what's going on here is some of the colder water penguins, such as these down here, they're called the Adelies. They actually are decreasing very rapidly in numbers. Where some of the other penguin species that came from the more northern and warmer climates, called the Parry Antarctic Island region, are moving down into these colder regions. And the Gentoo and Chinstrap penguins are doing quite fine. They're actually increasing in numbers. Whereas these Adelies have lost 60% of their numbers in the last 50 years or so. So it's a big problem, but scientists are there. They're studying it and keeping an eye on this up in 1976. Another image of it. And what they found there was an underground base that contained the black goo. Has anybody heard of the AI substance called black goo? Yep. This is where it's from. So the backstory on that is that it was called Operation Keyhole, interesting name the British picked, to take over this island, just this island. And an enormous effort went into capturing this island. 2-day battle, although it was just a surrender, and the Argentinians raised a white flag. They couldn't attempt to fight them. But the common narrative pertaining to the black goo is that it is an AI substance that can be used to rapidly clone any form of life. It was brought to Earth by benevolent ETs shortly after the Toba eruption some 74,000 years ago. Lake Toba is a massive caldera, much like I showed you Deception Island, that sunk and is a lake there now on the island of Sumatra in Indonesia. They call it the Toba eruption because it basically created a nuclear winter all across the world. And the human population was very small. In fact, about 60% of the human population died of starvation after the Toba eruption. So most of the amount of humans on the planet 74,000 years ago on the entire planet could fit into one of our largest stadiums. That's all there were of us. So the benevolent ETs felt that there was a threat, that we could be taken over. But the destiny of this planet is to be a human planet. It's a Homo sapien planet on the surface. But at that time, we were very vulnerable. So they brought the black goo here that has to be kept frozen. The black goo was deposited on Thule Island to be in a perpetual state of being frozen. And in one of the more remote corners of the planet to prevent it from escaping. The Argentinian government was tasked in the mid-1970s to secure the entrance to the underground ET base where they set up the Corbeta Uruguay station. So when I was down there, we got some copies of Nexus magazine. And we were reading it, and I was floored when I read this article in Nexus called Co-Evolution, an Interplanetary Adventure, in a section on hidden ET bases on Earth,
quote, "When we set up one of our bases on southern Thule, there was a good reason for this. Not only was it isolated, which suited our work, but it was also infected beneath its surface with what I call the Black Plague." This is an ET talking to a
person who would understand him.
It is like a concentration of negative energy. We wanted to see if we could nullify this plague before it made its way to the surface by accident or design. It is easier to control if it's kept in near 0 degrees, so it is best to work with it in the colder regions of your planet. Heat appears to be its friend. If it were ever to be released into the tropics, I don't think we could deal with it." End quote. So the common narrative pertaining to the black goo is that it is an AI substance. There's two kinds, one that is indigenous to this planet and another that was introduced, and that one that was introduced was stored here on southern Thule Island and can be used to rapidly clone any life form. This benevolent ET narrative to an intuitive human named Alec Newald continues, quote, "It was a setback to have our project at southern Thule shut down, even after our friends in Argentina tried to help. We have since moved to a new location where our work continues. It is not over yet. Perhaps one day you will know this, but never forget that we are not friends with the stars and stripes." And by the way, the British Union Jack has stripes on it, so I think it means the U.S. and Britain, who are very close allies. "If someone tells you that your ET brothers and sisters are coming to hold your hands to those that come to visit with the stars and stripes, let it be said that there is danger in the air, for this could never happen." So I think he's also referring to the possibility of a fake alien invasion that Captain Kramer talked about yesterday. And this black goo was deposited for a very specific reason, because it was not to be taken. But it was taken, and the Brits brought it back to London and started working with it, trying to backward engineer it, trying to figure out what the black goo was all about. Eric knows a lot about this too. And it escaped. It got out of their control, and it got into the sewers of London. There was a laboratory called Marconi Labs where many scientists died very mysteriously. It's still very hush-hush over there what was going on with it. And there's even some videos where you can see it in jars, and it just looks like tar. But when you bring two together, it attracts, and it has a kind of intelligence about it. It is an artificial intelligence. And these captions can kind of tell you some more information about what it does and how it operates. So many in the conspiracy world believe that this is the real reason why the Falkland Wars was conducted. It wasn't to get the sheep islands of Isle Maldivas. It was all about the black goo. All right, so just about done here. Finally, I told you about the shifting magnetic poles. They could be moving. And if they did move, and we had a pole shift scenario, this would be the next Antarctica, right over us. And the South Pole would then shift to just south of Australia. That would mean the ice would melt. The evidence for this is in a book by Charles Hapgood. And he had Albert Einstein write the foreword to his book. Both of them believe that an accumulation of ice on the North and South Poles could trigger a crustal displacement, that is, a geophysical pole shift. Einstein explained the triggering mechanism as follows. He wrote this foreword to the book, quote, "In a polar region, there is continual depositation of ice, which is not symmetrically distributed about the pole. The Earth's rotational acts on these unsymmetrical deposited masses and produces centrifugal momentum that is transmitted to the rigid crust of the Earth. The constant increasing centrifugal momentum produces in this way will, when it has reached a certain point, produce a movement of the Earth's crust over the rest of the Earth's body, and this will displace the polar regions towards the equator. So a pole shift is all going to be about what's going on with these magnetic poles, and if they drift too far from the geographical pole, it could be a 45-degree shift. Of course, everything would change. Earth would be thrown into turmoil. Volcanoes would erupt. Continents would rise and fall. Massive tsunamis would crash across the coastal regions. And we might be back to like that Toba experiment, although there are so many more of us today than there were back then, 74,000 years ago. But the point is, we are seeing signs that there is movement right now of the magnetic poles. So finally, I'd like to just share this little video I took, which was regarded as one of the best videos that we had, just right on my iPhone. This is looking out from Port Lockroy. My friend Luke there, he's on pole duty. We had to use poles to knock away the little icebergs, but we found these whales swimming right by us. These were identified by a marine biologist friend to be right whales. We're not getting audio, but I'll just kind of explain it to you. We're saying, oh, wow, look at how close they were. They were like from me to you away at this point, really close, and they're massive. They're almost as long as this room, just magnificent, huge beasts. And again, no fear of humans. They thought we were probably as unique to see as they were. And they just keep getting closer and closer. They were called right whales by the early whalers because, for a very macabre reason, look at that, right up to the boat and right underneath us. Yeah, that was pretty bizarre when there were three of them, three adults. And they just all three disappeared. It was like a Moby Dick moment. Like, oh, man, I hope I'm not going to end up in the belly of a whale. There's a view of our boat. Everybody's like, oh, wow, where are they? They're under there. But the right whales would stay atop the surface after they had been harpooned. And were nearly hunted to extinction. Look at the air bubbles. Then they're kind of playing tricks on us at the end and sort of blowing up air bubbles, saying hello. Of course, nothing happened. And that was the end of the movie, and that is the end of my presentation. So thank you very much. Thank you.